Podcast podcast audience. My name is Rob Rothman. For those of you who don't know me, I am a clinically practicing ophthalmologist. I am a glaucoma specialist by training. I spend about 50% of my time in clinical practice taking care of patients. The remainder of the time, I spend running a venture capital fund called InFocus Capital Partners. We are an ophthalmology-specific venture capital fund. We have closed our first fund and have 12 portfolio assets that we are currently navigating through the propagation of their clinical trials. And we are just beginning the launch of fundraising for our second ophthalmology-specific fund. Today's guest is kind of unique for me. Actually, it's pretty funny. It's the first guest I've actually been a little bit nervous to interview. So that's, you know, we'll get to that in a minute, but and for some specific reasons. But today's guest is Ellen Gould. And for those of you who don't know Ellen, she is a multi-Emmy award-winning actress and writer. She's a singer, performer. You're going to hear a whole bunch about her in a few minutes. But Ellen has shed light on a perspective that I think is very important, not only for me as a clinician and for anybody who's a clinician who listens to these podcasts, but also for, I guess, maybe aligning the values for investment that sometimes maybe we miss when we look at what we're doing in trying to define and identify promising technologies. We'll talk all about that in a little minute. But Ellen, thank you for taking the time to be on the podcast today, and I'm really looking forward to talking to you.
Thank you, Rob. While you were introducing yourself, I just want to congratulate you for doing something that a lot of clinicians don't do enough of, and also a lot of the biotech people who are doing such critical work, especially in inherited retinal disease, which I have. I have Stargardt's. Mm-hmm. And I know that making that connection between the patients that you really want to make a difference in their lives, knowing what that life experience is like, you know, it's really important, I think, to keep people motivated. You know, that you're doing great work. You're doing important work. It's hard. It's particular. It's slow. It's too slow for all of us. Wait for you.
It's funny that you bring it up like that, Ellen. I mean, it's not an insignificant part of the reason that I've decided to pivot a lot of my productive years towards the investment side of medicine. And that's because, you know, as a clinician, you're right, we oftentimes get stuck in exam rooms taking care of patients, really worrying more about how long people have been waiting in the waiting room and trying to just navigate the problems that exist at that moment in an exam lane. But the reality is that what we're really trying to do is help patients so that they can go on and live productive lives. It isn't about us. It isn't about the doctor, the clinician, the provider of care. It's about what we're doing for the patient. It's hard to remember that because medicine, as you know, has gotten a little bit challenging lately. But you're right. And I think that some of the things that we're going to talk about over the next half hour are things that people should remember and should help motivate them to consider what it is they're doing if they're going to be involved either in patient care or life sciences investing. Because, you know, my venture fund is run by myself and my partner, who's a physician, an ophthalmologist as well. We have a whole team of physicians. And one of the reasons why we think we are better investors is because we actually are thinking about you and about the people who are going to benefit from the technology as the most important aspect of where we invest. So that's a difference of opinion to some degree, maybe from, you know, why other people think investing in the space could be lucrative, but you're right. It is something that we consider important, and I know you appreciate that.
Very much. But I also get into a silo. You know, I'm coming from the theater world, and now film, actually. Wow. Right. Which I'll tell you about in a minute. But, you know, my impulse to write about My experience as someone who's been legally blind from age 15, it was not motivated to do the good, initially. It is now. I mean, now I initially my mission was to do good art, and really even before that, to tell a story that it was meaningful to me from my belly button. The passion is what drives the writer, the performer. The passion is what drives you. It's what drives the art of everything, right?
Right. Can you tell everybody, Ellen, a little bit about your past? There's a lot of, I mean, there's probably a lot of Emmy winning people that I could talk to, but on why is this is a relevant one for an ophthalmology, investor sort of podcast. So can you tell a little bit about, your childhood when you first started to have visual symptoms, how it affected you as a young person, and how those things have transformed you into the person you are today? I think it's critical to talk about your journey so that people understand, why we're talking today.
Great, definitely happy to do that. I didn't know that I had really lost a lot of my central vision until I was probably 14 or 15. I was reading from a book and I kept thinking I had a fleck or something in my vision or some liquid. It was a haze. And I would move my eyes around the page. I could kind of locate the words, but when I looked straight at the words, they would jump. It was concerning. I told my parents. When I was growing up, no, I don't think people understood Stargardt's. Originally, the ophthalmologist I went to said, "Oh, I think it might be optic neuropathy," which I know is the catch bucket. When you don't know what something is, it's neuropathy.
It's kind of true. I mean, neuro-ophthalmologists would be mad for me, mad at me for saying it, but you're right. When we can't figure something else, we blame it on a neurologic problem.
And it started that way. But I had a wonderful ophthalmologist who said, "Look, I don't know what it is." And he sent me to Boston Eye and Ear. And at that time, it was Ephraim Friedman. He was toward the end of his career at that point. Wonderful man. I mean, hugely compassionate and a wonderful doctor and researcher. And he was the one that diagnosed me with Stargardt's, which at the time was, we understood was exceedingly rare. It's still a rare disease, but not quite so rare. And at the time, also, it was considered juvenile macular degeneration.
Right.
Now people are diagnosed with it based on genetic modeling well into their 50s. It's different animal that obviously I don't have to tell all of your audience than AMD, but it functions much like that, or rather, one functions with it much like one does. And the other thing that I'd come to understand interviewing many women for this show, now film, who have Stargardt's, we all see very differently from each other. The central scleroderma is different in each eye and different from patient to patient. So the functional vision is, he can vary enormously. And I'm one of the lucky ones. I never got a second round of vision loss. I'm 2200. My scleromas are in different places, so I have very a lot of usable vision. And even a fair, I think I have color vision, full color vision, but again, I can't compare it to
Right.
anybody else. I don't know how anyone else sees. It was very troubling, obviously,
Right.
and became more troubling when I came to New York to try and begin a life as an actor. And doing cold readings was not fun.
Right. How do you, reading must have been in general. How do you read the lines, right? So.
Oh God, it was, the one good thing. Either I came into the world with a good memory. My mother had a great memory, so maybe. Some of it might have been necessity, but I have, though I don't see terribly well, I have a photographic memory. So if I could manage to take in the page, if I could scan it enough with my peripheral vision, I was able to, I could really gobble up two or three pages enough so that if I played with the script, then maybe I could, come through with a cold reading. But it was not easy. The gift of all of this is there was a nascent writer in me, and as I began to have more mild, thankfully, incremental vision loss, it began to push me toward writing. And that was the greatest gift ultimately for me in my career, because making it in theater, film, very difficult. One tenth of 1% of the I was a sociology major, so I did the research. Very few people make a living in this business. Those that do usually make an enormous amount of money. There's a very small group of us who work pretty regularly and have made a reasonable career, but not household names. But I have a control over my career artistically that I probably never would have had if I w had been more able to get more parts through more cold readings. I would probably be what they say, what they call a working actor. And I wouldn't have had the opportunity to control my artistic life the way I've been able to do.
Right, more acting, less writing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And now I'm about, I would say, about half and half.
So let me ask you a question. So you were diagnosed when you were in high school, I imagine, and then
15.
you went through college. When did your visual loss really become most manifest? I mean, when did you feel like it sort of peaked out? I would imagine this has impacted you every day since then. But was there anything specific about the experiences that you had growing up that particularly motivated you or you think had an impact on the path that you chose creatively later on?
No question. This is how actually the show begins. I was told by Dr. Friedman that I likely started losing vision as early as 7, but you don't know, you don't have anything to compare it to. So I did notice that where I'd been one of the smart kids in the class early on, once there was board work, which was probably around the time that I was losing vision, I had to go very close to the board, and even then I couldn't really see it. And I started getting reports, my parents did, that I was not a motivated kid. As one of my teachers wrote back, she's one of the brightest children in the class, but she does not work up to her ability. And let me tell you, I felt like I'd failed. I felt like a failure. And I carried that with me for years. I'm like, I am such an overachiever because I was fighting that. It was the reaction to that early feeling of really feeling like I just wasn't measuring up to me. And that was an awful thing to carry. And I'm sure that that motivated me a lot to write the story, to be that voice for other kids who are going through it in present time, and those who don't yet know that they have an inherited retinal disease that isn't showing fully until it is so apparent that And if they're lucky enough to get diagnosed properly. So that's a mission for me right now. But it did, I went away. One of the things I did very early on, because I love to sing and I had a crazy imagination, and when I couldn't see what was going on in the class, I would go away. And I would imagine myself on stage, and I was the star, the actual,
So there
So.
was so it impacted you. It clearly, I mean, it you know, having a disability, and I've heard this from many people, you know, has a huge role in shaping who you are, but it doesn't always work out great, right? Some people regress or recede into, you know, some sort of, you know, I don't know, despair or self-pity or whatever they want to call it. And other people excel, right? And I think that there's loads of people who might serve as examples of those who've excelled, right? And there's a fundamental difference between those people. You're clearly, you know, one of those people who's chosen to take this and turn it into something positive. And I want to talk about seeing stars, but before we get to that, for those of you who are watching this, you might notice over Ellen's left shoulder, there are two very tastefully placed Emmy Awards sitting right there in the background. And how did you get those? I mean, what? I mean, I know what they were for, but I mean, can you tell the audience how your career started to transform when you realized that you were going to, you know, utilize whatever motivation you had from being who you were, turn it into something positive that would not only be recognized, you know, by individual people in an audience, but also by, you know, those who determine that it's the best. How did that happen?
Oh my God. Well, the short answer is I fell into a manhole. How did that change the trajectory of my life and bring me up instead of down? Well, I was on my way to probably the biggest show I'd gotten into at the Public Theater, and I was all dressed up, and I went out. Young actress, not able to take a cab, but I was going to do it anyway because I was all done up. And there was an enormous truck in the intersection when I went down to the street, and I had to walk around it, and I'm hailing a cab and I'm walking backwards, and the cabs didn't come, and I kept walking backwards, and the cab finally came, and it came so close to me, I had to step back so it didn't hit me, and I disappeared. And the truck had been blocking a manhole, and the guys were off having coffee, and they didn't put the protections around the hole. And was it because of my vision? Probably that had something to do with it. I liked to think at the time, and looking back now, I'm thinking maybe I was in denial. It didn't have anything to do with my vision. And in fact, I did get quite a nice settlement from the electric company because they really were, remiss. So I had to go to the hospital, and I thought, oh, I'm going to be late for my first rehearsal. And it turned out I had broken three ribs, bruised a kidney. I was in bed for 3 months, missed the show. I was a mess, desolate. The Public Theater, for anybody who doesn't know theater in New York, that's where Chorus Line began. And the show I was supposed to be in was going to be on that stage at the Public Theater. And I thought my life was over. Well, I took the settlement I got first. I spent those 3 months in bed writing my first solo musical. And with the settlement, I developed and shopped it around, and it went into a small off-Broadway house, and I got rave reviews in the New York Times, and my career began.
What was that called? What was that show called?
It was called Confessions of a Reformed Romantic,
Okay.
about gut punch of getting your dreams dashed. And so that was the turning point for me, both the down and then the up. And then one of the next shows that I did ended up off Broadway and on public television, and I got the two Emmys for that show, that second show. But the beautiful irony was, guess where that Emmy award-winning show debuted?
Where? The theater, Pogue Theater.
That same stage,
There you go.
the show that I would have been in if I hadn't fallen in the manhole.
And what was that show called?
It was called Bubba Mice's Bubby Stories, about my grandma, my bubbies, and their immigrant experience. It's still available. I think it's actually available on Amazon. You can buy the DVD, and not an ad, just if anyone's
You can
interested.
promote, you can do whatever you want on this podcast. You can certainly encourage people to buy it. Go ahead. But that's so that was really, so just to go back a step, really having this, lost opportunity because of, the inadvertent trip into the bowels of Manhattan, really set off your writing career. That was really what started you down the path of writing. I mean, you had been an actress prior to that, but that's really kind of how you sort of shifted or pivoted and went a little laterally and started to write. Did the experience of losing that opportunity play into the script for that first show?
It did, but indirectly. I didn't write specifically about the incident, but I did talk about, the loves we have and the loves we lose. And for sure, sight is, everybody's main squeeze. So even though I'd lost a lot of sight at that point, I'd lost a great opportunity. I'd lost something I'd set my sights on. God, this is bringing up a lot of those feelings as we're talking. Amazing. That incredible turnaround. It's like when the joy of you do so much work. You do it in the sciences. Everything takes so much time. I mean, I'm encapsulating this, right? It took me 3 months to write that first show. It was a much simpler show than the next one, and much more simpler than the one I've just finished. It all takes time, but the time is, the process is also a wonderful one. And I love the writing. I think much like you as a clinician and then research, it's all different, but they're all different creative expressions, and they all take something very different. I'm sorry, I'm going off on
No,
a
it's fantastic.
tangent.
That's exactly. I it's great. I mean, the reason I ask is because, I mean, look, you and I have had a chance to talk before, and there were some interesting things about some of the comments that you made that you may not even realize that you made at those times, but they sort of caused a little bit of a realization in me. So the impact that our first conversation had on me was really to kind of make me understand that when people are motivated to do anything productive, there is an immense sense of satisfaction when there's success, but there's also an immense sense of sadness when they fail, right? I mean, it's the same thing. And if you really care about what you're doing, then you really realize that. And I know it's maybe it's a little trite, but you can't really understand what success is unless you've had failure, right? You have to kind of have those experiences in order to sort of make you put things in the proper perspective. So I got that from you because, and we'll talk a little bit about Seeing Stars in a minute because I know you want to get to it and I want to get to it and I want people to hear about it. But you go through a lot before you get, I think a lot of people go through a lot before they really achieve what they want to achieve. And it isn't a sprint, right? It's not a sprint. It's always a marathon, and it always takes time. And there's always ups and downs along the path, but we've all had those. Yours has been a little bit more difficult because you also have a visual disability. But kind of is what it is. But anyway, sorry to stir up those emotions, but I think they're important for people to get the context. So tell us, so here you are. You've decided that you were going to write a show. It ends up being a success. You decide you're going to write another show. You win a couple of Emmys for it, gets on TV. So where does Seeing Stars come from? Why don't you tell people what Seeing Stars is? I'm fascinated by what this is, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing it. And I'll explain why later, but tell people what it is and what you're doing now.
Okay, so about 20 years ago, I had the idea. Well, I didn't. When I after I did the Emmy award-winning show, someone I went to college with was working at the Lighthouse Guild, then the Lighthouse, and she called me and said she knew I didn't think I had told anybody. I was very, not out and proud about my vision because I could pass, so I hit it when I could. But somehow, I guess she knew. And she said, "Why don't you write something about your vision?" And I went, "Oh." And I wasn't sure I wanted to be that forthcoming about my vision, because in the biz, at that time, especially even 20 years ago, disability, it wasn't cool. It's cool now. So I thought, oh, but it really intrigued me. So I wrote a small one-act musical about my own experience. And a lot of my colleagues saw it and they said, there's something universal about this. It's about vision. The metaphors abound, the potential. This is great stuff. And I went, yeah, but I didn't want to write a whole show about me. It just felt too confessional in a way that I was not comfortable with. And I also felt it was a little too, solipsistic. I don't know, the whole thing felt icky. So, but I did want to do something. I knew there was something in there. So over the 20 years, in between other projects I was doing, and I was, getting shows done in New York. They weren't as big as the Emmy award-winning one, but I was working. And I would go back to this piece. And about 8 years ago, it hit me. I'm going to look for other women who had Stargardt's and had it legally blind as kids. I want to know what their experience was like. And maybe in that, I can find really wonderful, interesting stories and something will emerge. So I interviewed, oh, so many people. And I narrowed it down to five, and I took hour-long interviews. And I took, this is over a period of years, took me a year to find them with HIPAA stuff, and then another year to interview them, culled down to five, and then another year to musicalize these monologues, stories and song kind of interspersed. It was a really unique kind of form I was playing with. It was fun. And then I got myself a director, worked with my musical director of many, many years. And then we went into rehearsal. And then I applied. I got into a major solo festival because I play all these women. And there were 130 shows. I figured I was going to get some attention from the disability community. I ended up, people, actors and different people they told about within the festival heard about it. I don't know how, and they started coming, and I kept getting extra shows added on. And by the end of the festival, out of the 130 shows, it won the top show, and I was offered a chance to do it on the West End the following year. Well, that was 2020. That didn't happen, but it was clear that there was. That the message went, it was clearly about disability and vision disability, but it really was about vision in the full metaphorical sense. I mean, I couldn't explore all of it. It's so juicy, but it really was ultimately about resilience. because it's not just me. These women leave me in the dust. I mean, one after another of them, they are the most remarkable. I almost didn't do the first interview. I have to tell you, I had an anxiety attack. I thought, oh no, because I know me, I love people. And if I get to know people, I'll end up with them. That's just the way I am. Rob, you're never going to get rid of me now because I really like you. But, so I thought, oh no, I'm opening up the door to, I'm going to now have a whole community of people who are limping and disabled. I mean, that's a terrible thing. And then I realized as I was writing this, what I was afraid of is that inner thing in me that said I was limping and disabled. I'm not, they're not,
Right.
nobody is. We are only as we see ourselves. And that is what this show is about.
It's for people who, wonder how we became connected and why I wanted to have this interview. The person who connected us is a mutual good friend of both of ours named Paul Rib. And Paul is somebody who also suffers with inherited central visual loss due to retinal dystrophy. And Paul, in addition to being a world champion visually impaired tennis player, as I'm sure you know, is
Yes.
now focusing all of his financial talents on helping companies raise money so that they continue to propagate work and prevent or treat people with ophthalmic disease. His story and your story resonate very similarly with me. And that was the reason why I found this so compelling. And that's because here are people, I don't know if Paul has any hidden singing or acting talents, but my guess is that that's probably a big zero for him. I at least played the King and the King and I in sixth grade, so I get a
Oh,
little bit of a pass. So I get a little bit of a pass because I do have
hey.
some juvenile acting experience from when I was 10 and 11 years old. I bet based on what Paul sounds like, I would imagine he can hold a tune just as well as I can, which is not at all. But yet, here you have two people who are very similar with regard to a visual impairment and have led to completely different lives, but are having such a huge impact on the community at large with visual loss. It's kind of an interesting thing. And then here you go and make a movie about regular people. This is not a Hollywood, fantasized vision of somebody who grows up, has some childhood trauma or disability or whatever, and then grows up and becomes, something special. Those stories are, of course, compelling and exciting. These are people who just live regular lives. I mean, you live a regular life. Paul lives a regular life. The women in your show live regular lives, and yet each of the people has had the ability to not only overcome but succeed. And it's fascinating to me that that happens, because it's kind of a unique story, if you ask me. I just don't think that that happens all the time that people do this. The fact that you turned it into a show is even more, sort of interesting. It's like, who would have thought to take these stories and turn them into, a performance of what life was like and can relate it in a way where people can understand the difficulties of living with visual disability, but also how rewarding the experiences you have as a person with visual disability can be. It's a fascinating story to me.
I'm glad. I think well, I think one of the things that makes me so happy, and I didn't think really about why is this show different than all other shows, but this is the first time that people with limited vision, not blind, are heroes in their own stories. Five of them. That is kind of cool. And they're
I
all
agree. I
so
agree.
different. One of them is a beauty pageant queen, and she's 19. Another one is 30 something, and is works in a planetarium, but is semi-scientific. And another one is was a fashion industry executive, a star in the business until she had her Stargardts later at 33, became a vision, what do you call it, disability expert,
Advocate.
a
Yeah, okay.
vision disability, like accessibility expert. And I do a very sexy accessibility wrap in this for anybody who's interested, for all the different tools, the long arm acrobat and handheld mags and all of that. So that should give your community a huge thrill, I hope. Then there is a woman who don't give her there were privacy issues. It was a very difficult story. A woman who lost her vision and her husband left her as she was losing her vision. So not all the stories are Pollyannish, but there, even there, you see a spiritual strength, but it's not a happy ending. And then the writer character based on me, loosely based on me, and a couple of others. But they're varied. Their vision is different. Their vision of themselves and the world is different. They have all been, they're all very accomplished. They may not be stars, household names, or glamorous, although most of them are very elegant. I've been told, I didn't say this, a doctor I know said that people with Stargardts tend to be more attractive than the average population in his armchair evaluation. I don't
Well,
know. I
you know what's funny? I've been told that I look much better. You know, I'm much more handsome by people who have central scotomas, which is probably why you like me.
Oh,
So
you're gorgeous, Bob.
there's a coincidence right there, right? The less you can see of me, the better looking I am. It's pretty fascinating.
And I have to tell you, the older I get, the younger I look. You know, I don't see a line on my face. That's one of the major benefits of retinal issues.
Well, you know, so look, I think that everybody in the world has faced some sort of adversity in their life, and I think people deal with adversity in their own way, and there's no judgment about that. I mean, it's impossible to walk in somebody else's shoes and know how to be able to judge their response. But I find the overcoming of obstacles, you know, incredible. And they're usually motivating and uplifting stories. And I think that's one of the reasons why they're often sought after as topics for commercialization. You know, let's make movies about this. Let's make like this story, the success of facing adversity and overcoming it is really the fundamental story of almost everything that we read or watch, right? That's basically, you know, what theater is, even going back to, you know, Shakespearean type stories, right? But the real world often looks different, right? And I think that's the unique part of your show, is that, and a unique part of the story that you're telling is what it's like in the real world. And it isn't romanticized. It isn't idolized in a way that makes us think that the people that you are talking about are superheroes. It's about the everyday living with something that affects every minute of you and how you deal with that, how you navigate it, and how you overcome those challenges to find meaning and happiness. And that, I think, is the real story that needs to be told more frequently. It puts into context for me, and this is the fundamental reason why I'm fascinated by what you've done, the fundamental reason about for why I do what I do. I mean, even at the fundamental level of being a provider of ophthalmic care as a glaucoma specialist, and why it's carried itself into, you know, the investment thesis for, you know, the fund that I'm currently running. And I think that it's really those stories that are the most compelling. And I can tell you know, at least from the perspective of people who I've told about you, that they are very anxious to see seeing stars whenever we can, which is when can we see seeing stars, by the way?
Okay, so three phases this movie project. The first one's done. It's the soundtrack, and I'm so excited about it. Orchestrations. My music director did magic. I mean, they're really beautiful. Now I'm looking to get the next chunk of funding, and then I can put the key in the ignition for the film phase, which I would love, ideally. I'm projecting the late fall of this year, and then it's post-production. Post-production is longer and more expensive, but you can fundraise off the what you have in the can for the filming, so that's great. So that's where I am on it, and if I can get the filming done before the end of the year, I'm hoping I have my producer from Bubba Mises sort of circling and looking to PBS or that kind of, platform. There are no guarantees, of course, but I was there before. It certainly would help for the next. So that looks to be the, projection, the trajectory. We'll see. I've got a 7-minute preview video of it. When you put your link up for people, maybe I can share that if anybody wants to see what it looks like. A clip
Definitely.
of the original Solo Festival show and in the recording studio with the musicians, and it's a pretty exciting little piece of what's coming.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, I should be telling everybody about our deal. Why not? So the deal that Ellen and I made was that if I did a good job on the podcast, and she gets nominated for an Academy Award for the film, I get to go to the awards, right? Is that the deal?
Yep, and
That's the
now I'm
deal.
absolutely committed to it because
There you go. So there you have it. So, well, now it's recorded. So now you kind of have no choice.
I
You
think
know, you
so.
just,
But
I mean,
I have
there's.
something else for you. I'm throwing a gauntlet down, okay? As you were
Okay.
talking, it made me wonder something I've wondered every time I've gone into an eye doctor's office from the beginning. And I would love one time to interview you for the podcast and find out what it was that made you want to go into being a physician dealing with eye with
Yeah,
vision.
that's a good question. I will probably need to do a lot of soul searching before I answer that. I've been asked that question before. I don't know that I have a really good answer, but I think I'm developing one as I get older. So I'm happy to have that podcast. I would love to have that opportunity. So let's make a deal. You get your movie out, and then we'll come back and you can interview me. We'll talk to each other about all that success. Thank you so much for sharing a little bit about your journey and about what you have planned for the future. Again, on a personal note, it's truly inspirational, and I'm happy that you found an outlet that allows other people to experience your journey in a way that's both meaningful and enjoyable. And I think it will be well received. Congratulations on your past success, and I'm looking forward to seeing the fruition of seeing stars make it to the screen. And I'm looking forward to coming back here at some point in the near future for you to ask me a whole bunch of personal questions.
Yes.
To Ellen Gould, thank you
Promise.
so much. Thank you, OIS podcast audience. I hope you enjoy this. I'm looking forward to the next time we can speak again.